Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We've got quite a treat for you. My friend Tom Drew has assembled a group of people who met at Duke University earlier today to talk about the Watergate break-in and phone tapping experience and what was really behind it. I wasn't able to join them for that meeting, but what they learned and what they shared with others was some of the background about what was really going on, why the people wanted a phone tap. And my friend Hiding Carter was there, and you moderated that event, didn't you, Hiding?
Today.
Could you moderate our discussion, introduce?
Sure. I'll begin the introduction anyway. After that, I get run over by the feature attraction. On my left is Spencer Oliver, who was the owner, so to speak, of the only phone on which a tap worked.
He's the guy who got tapped.
He's the guy in which they finally found that he was the guy that got tapped. And he was at the time running the state Democratic Chairman's Association, but had been involved in Democratic Party politics since he was 2 years old. Beyond him is Sam Poole, who has been, again, as all of you all know in North Carolina, deeply involved in a number of political activities. And I have to make clear that there were two themes today. One was Watergate, and one was Terry Sanford.
Why?
Because there was a distinct feeling among a number of us, not just from the South, that McGovern was going to be a disaster and that it was necessary to find somebody
who could block it. Excuse me for interrupting, but for those who weren't here, 1972 was the year that McGovern got the Democratic nomination and then ultimately lost in a sweep.
We all learn how to do this, and we're moderators. So that's why I was doing it, okay. Yes, the thing is that McGovern became increasingly looking inevitable, which meant inevitably we were going to get wiped out in the national election. That was not even a question. There were a number of folk who seemed to be likely possibilities, but almost everybody in this group had been in the original Sanford for President campaign, some a lot longer than others, these two. But by the time, and so we had people here from who had been state chair in Massachusetts, Maine, in South Carolina, Arizona, who had all been together for Terry before Watergate.
So, Hiding, this was a group today, on the day that we were recording this program, and it was in one sense a reunion and a celebration of Terry Sanford and the recollection of the possibility that he might have been president, and then looking at what that Watergate had something to do maybe with keeping him from having the opportunity to be president.
The thesis, which Spencer is going to go deeply into, is simply that they looked out on a world in which a number of possibilities bothered them, but that Terry in many ways bothered them the most because he was a guy who could appeal across the board in ways that each of the other candidates—
They being the Republicans.
Yes, and the one thing I want to say before we go any further and Spencer takes it, is that in the latter part of 1971, in the earlier part of 72, the polls did not show Nixon doing well. So there was a good reason for paranoia to begin with. If you are a paranoid who runs a paranoid party organization, then what you decide is, let's see if we can't wreck all the possible candidates and see if we can't clear the way in one way or another for Mr. McGovern. You know all the stories of the various tricks that were played, the downfall of Ed Muskie, which was one of their dirty tricks, but there were a number. Spencer was a man in close contact with all the state chairs. The information he had about what was going on in the party was extensive, and he had first met Terry in a sense of maybe this is something to do when Terry said to him 3 years earlier, I think I want to run for president. Stop. His phone got tapped for, you speculate, but it's clear given the period that what they were really looking for was whatever they could get to impede any possibility for Terry, and this went on for some time. Why were you tapped, Spencer?
Well, it was part of the Nixon campaign that had begun in 1971. To try to manipulate and control and influence the nominating process in the Democratic Party. So they had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars recruiting saboteurs like this fellow Donald Segretti. I think they had about 50 of them who transgressed the United States and did everything they could to disrupt the Democratic campaigns, the Muskie thing in New Hampshire and other things in Florida, and sending 400 pizzas to a headquarters, in the name of Muskie or someone. And what they did was everything possible to ensure that not only did they disrupt the campaign, but they divided the party in such a way that there were hard feelings by everybody, because no one suspected that what was going on was something being orchestrated by the Republican army of saboteurs. So one of the things that they needed to do in order to have the information that would allow them to assign these people to do various things was to know what was going on in the Democratic Party. And at the time, I was the director of the State Democratic Chairman's Association and the Democratic National Committee, which was sort of the center of information between and among state parties and state party chairmen, vice chairs, executive directors, and all of the people who were involved in the nominating process, not only just the state chairs, but also the various campaigns and candidates. I was in touch on a regular basis with the key delegate counters and campaign managers for Humphrey and Muskie and McGovern, and knew all these people very well. But they wanted to tap that telephone in order to get that information.
Spencer, I hate to get you off track, but could you sort of put it in context what the Democratic campaign looked like in terms of the people who were the candidates and what their relative strengths were and what their challenges or problems were?
Well, throughout 1971, Muskie looked almost inevitable. All the polls that were being taken showed him defeating Nixon by major margins. McGovern was sort of the inheritor of the anti-war movement and the Bobby Kennedy organization. And then you also had Hubert Humphrey, who had been the nominee in 68 and wanted to run again, still had a strong organization and a lot of appeal within the Democratic Party. Then you had others like Harold Hughes of Iowa, who's a name you probably never heard of, and John Lindsay and these various people. But one of the reasons that there was such a multiple field was because, as Hodding said earlier, Nixon was vulnerable. He was not a popular president in 1971 and early 1972. So they thought they needed to do something a little extra to make sure that he won by destroying the Democratic candidates in advance.
Did the in this effort, this secret effort to destroy or harm the campaigns of what might be viable Democratic candidates, did they take any position at all in either helping or harming the McGovern campaign?
Well, they were trying primarily to undermine the candidacies of those Democrats.
Trying to help McGovern by harming the opposition.
By trying to undermine the campaigns of Muskie and Humphrey and Scoop Jackson, who was another one who they feared because he was a centrist candidate, strong on national defense.
Will you remind us how they destroyed the Muskie campaign?
Well, the story of the Muskie campaign is, of course, Muskie had been a very popular vice presidential nominee in 1968 and had performed extraordinarily well and was considered the strongest candidate, the most popular candidate. All of the main fundraisers and campaign organizers and managers all flocked to the Muskie campaign because they thought that was the train that was going to leave the station and win the nomination. So he was McGovern, had the kids who had been anti-war, who had been brought into the campaigns of Gene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy in 68. McGovern was sort of the inheritor of those of that group of people within the party. Scoop Jackson was a favorite of organized labor. He was a strong hardliner, anti-Soviet pro-defense and a person with a very good reputation in the Democratic Party. Then you had people, you know, others like Harold Hughes from Iowa, who was a sort of a newcomer. I think at one point Ramsey Clark was even one of the one of the potential candidates, but I don't think he ever really got off the ground. Then you had Shirley Chisholm, who was a woman, an African American, who had a unique cachet for certain elements of the electorate. So it was a big
Spencer,
campaign.
Excuse me.
But
let me get you were going to explain to me what they did to get to get Muskie.
Well, they did.
Let me tell you what I remember. You know that they attacked his wife and he cried, and all of a sudden it was over. But that wasn't it, was that?
Well, there were a lot of things that they did, but in New Hampshire to Muskie, they would have phone calls come into houses at 3 o'clock in the morning from phone banks saying, "Don't forget to vote for Muskie." So they were waking up everybody in New Hampshire by disrupting their sleep. They had a letter a phony letter that was released that had Muskie referring to Canucks, which was a pejorative designation. They did a number of things like this, and they attacked his wife, and particularly it was the Manchester Union leader that editorialized and gave bad publicity to his wife, indicating
Fox Broadcasting in print is what.
So
Manchester.
So Muskie was after a long day of campaigning. He'd been in several states. He came up to New Hampshire, and he was speaking in a snowstorm and in front of the Manchester Union leader, where he wanted to criticize the Manchester Union leader and its publisher for these attacks on his wife. And at one point, Muskie was an emotional speaker, but he got choked up. And people thought he cried, but people who were standing there didn't think he cried. It was he was an emotional inflection in his voice, but it was snowing. So there was, you know, snow coming down his face, and it made it look like he was crying. And with the inflection in his voice, it looked as though he had choked up and cried. The press wrote it as though he had cried. I mean, this was the, you know, the pool press, and somebody wrote the lead and everybody followed it.
But that wasn't part of the conspiracy or
no, but it was all of the things that had been done by these tricksters that had brought him to this emotional state of these people are doing terrible things and I'm going to lash out at them and respond to this. But
he loved his wife a lot. She had a bad drinking problem.
But
they played games with her.
But
and he'd been in North Carolina that day, by the way. So
I tell you what, I keep interrupting you. I'm going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to let you tell the story.
Fine, DG.
You know, our special guest is Spencer Oliver, but helping us with the conversation is Hiding Carter, and also is Sam Poole. And in the wings, we have Tom Drew to help us if we get stuck. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking with a group of distinguished people who are very well informed about an event that is now history and related to the 1972 presidential campaign, in which, at the end, President Richard Nixon trounced the Democratic nominee, George McGovern. We all know that as a part of the campaign, the Watergate scandal broke. But what I didn't know and what this distinguished group of Spencer Oliver, Hiding Carter, Sam Poole, Tom Drew are telling me is that there was something sinister going on that had a direct impact on who the Democratic nominee was. Spencer, I kept interrupting you, but keep on telling the
DJ,
story.
DJ, the thing was that the efforts of the Nixon people and their saboteurs and the various things that they did undermined Democratic candidates who were the most viable and the ones who were the most danger to them. So as you moved through the process, McGovern, who they left alone, was continuing to increase his delegate count as they went along, as others dropped by the wayside or their campaigns became inoperative. The Democratic Party state chairman, who I was the main staff person for, were terrified that the nomination of George McGovern would mean that they would lose a lot of down ballot races, governors, congressmen, state legislatures, because McGovern was considered so far to the left and not popular in many states, particularly southern states. So there was an effort by Hodding and me and Sam and some others to launch Terry Sanford's campaign through the North Carolina primary, pitting him up against George Wallace, so that Terry would have a clean shot at George Wallace in North Carolina and launch the campaign as the others fell by the wayside. Of course, they heard a lot of this planning. They knew what we were doing. And as the convention...
But why? Because they tapped your phone?
Yes, because they tapped my phone. And there were a lot of people who said, why did they tap the phone at Watergate? Well, the person who put the tap on my phone was a man named James McCord, who was one of the people who was caught in the Watergate on the night of the burglary. And he was an ex-CIA specialist on wiretapping. So they had brought him in to put the taps on Larry O'Brien's phone and my phone. The tap on Larry's phone didn't work, and mine did. But I saw McCord eventually in the Watergate trial came forward to the judge and said there's been perjury here. He, in effect, blew the whistle on his colleagues and turned over, became state's evidence, in effect, and who upset their plans to limit the Watergate prosecution to just a few people who were caught, who were all going to plead guilty and take the rap, and that would be the end of it. But McCord said, I am not going to do this. There has been pressure put on us. There has been perjury in the trial, and there's something wrong here. And Judge Sirica then acted to try to expose what was going on. Woodward and Bernstein at the Washington Post were starting to write stories, and it became more of an issue about not just what did they learn, but why did they do it. So I asked McCord 2 years later when I saw him in the offices of one of my lawyers who wanted me to meet him, and he wanted to meet me, and so I came to this office. And
it's kind of like you tap my telephone.
There he was. That's right. There he was. Hi, I'm Jim McCord. I said, yes, I know who you are. He said, I know a lot about you, too. Well, and we had a nice conversation. And I said to him, you know, there's a lot of speculation. Why my phone? Although there was a lot of information that would go through, it wasn't as though I was Larry O'Brien or someone at that level. I thought it was kind of silly to tap my phone at the time because I didn't think there was anything that I had any information that would be of any value to anybody. But, of course, I didn't know at that time what they'd been doing or why they were doing it. And McCord said to me, well, Spencer, we knew who you were. We knew who everybody in the Democratic National Committee headquarters was. We knew where their offices were. We knew who their secretaries were. We knew what their job descriptions were. And we put the tap on your phone because we thought we would get good information about what was going on around the country in the Democratic Party through the state chairman that you would be talking to. And that's why we did it.
Well, let me pursue that just a little bit. What y'all are telling me is that these guys had a very definite mission, and that was to diminish the favorability or to get the best Democratic candidates out of the campaign. I'm thinking as you talk about it that it looks like it's more we just kind of want to know what's going on with the Democrats. It's sort of a general intelligence effort rather than one that's specifically aimed at the candidates. But we just like to know from Spencer, he's talking to all these guys, what's going on so we don't get surprised?
Well, their objective was to secure the nomination for McGovern, who they thought would be.
How do we know that?
Well, they said so.
McCord will now say that's
what
we're
doing. Well, it's not only McCord. There are several others in John Dean's latest book and quite others. It's fairly well documented.
We, the Republicans, we had a plan.
That's right.
We were going to do everything we could to help the Democrats nominate McGovern.
That's
and do
right.
everything we could to not help those who might be pushing some other candidate.
That's absolutely correct. And when they had the tap on my phone was when the time, in addition to doing the State Chairman's Association, I was also deeply involved in the Terry Sanford for President campaign. Sanford's campaign, although it had started, you know, early on in terms of his candidacy, his real campaign was to begin in North Carolina with the primary. Although he had people like Tom Drew and Sam and others who were going around the country, he had a lot of friends everywhere. I mean, Terry had been a very popular governor. He had been a very popular educator. He was well-known and well-liked by all elements of the Democratic Party across the board.
And across the country.
Across the board, but I mean across the board left and right.
Mm-hmm,
liberals,
mm-hmm.
conservatives, southerners, northerners, so on. So it was an effort by us to, as the others fell by the wayside, to try to block McGovern. The state chairs wanted to block McGovern in order to put somebody else at the top of the ticket who would help their local races rather than hurt them. And for us, we wanted a deadlock convention in order to put forward Sanford's candidacy as the compromise candidate who everybody loved and nobody disliked. And we had in the first roll call, I think we had 128 votes. Is that right, Tom? And from 22 states. And in these states were key people. People who, Bob Allen, who was national president of the Young Democrats in Arizona, Hodding Carter, who was co-chairman of the party in Mississippi and who nominated Terry, Andrew Miller in Virginia, who was the attorney general, who seconded the nomination of Terry. And then, of course, there were a lot of delegates from North Carolina and a variety of delegates throughout the country. Philip Keegan in New Jersey, who was a county freeholder and later party chairman, had several votes. Toni Morrison in Louisiana. We had people who were activists within their states and influential. So that when the other candidacies fell apart, one
you
of the things—
strength. You might not have had a lot of votes, but you had a lot of strong votes and a lot of strong people.
If there was a deadlock and the delegates who were committed to other delegates had to go somewhere else, the uncommitted, the Muskie people, you know, the Jackson people, the Chisholm people, the Hughes people, favorite sons, where would they go? If all the other candidates had been destroyed— and they didn't want McGovern because he was too far to the left or perceived to be too far to the left, where would they go? They would look for someone who was a moderate, who was popular, and who had no enemies in the party.
Well, what did the Republicans do to keep that effort from working?
Well, one of the things that we talked about during that period of time and was that the state chairman wanted to know— whether or not McGovern would have the nomination locked up if he won the California primary on June the 3rd. So we started in probably about the time that just after the tap was put on, doing a survey of every state, the state chairs and the vice chairs and the executive directors, to determine where these delegates would go in the event that their candidate failed. Or where would the uncommitted go?
Who would the second choices be?
I mean, how long would they hold out against McGovern? How long would Humphrey people fold, and would they be likely to go to Sanford or Scoop Jackson if their guy was out? This was the best count in the country. We knew from my phone, the fellow who was really in charge of the count was Don Fowler, who was there today at our earlier meeting, who was the state chairman of South Carolina at the time. And between his office and my office, we conducted this survey. We had this information, and we—
And what did it show?
It concluded that McGovern did not have the nomination wrapped up if he won the California primary. There were still ways that he could be stopped. And one of the ways was at the Texas Democratic Convention, which took place on June the 13th. So Terry Sanford suggested that I should go down there and talk to them because I'd grown up in Texas. I'd grown up in Texas politics. I knew a lot of the players. And in those days, you didn't have candidates who were bound by results in primaries. It was all pretty well open. So that under the Texas rules, the party convention could take all the delegates away from McGovern and split them among Humphrey, Wallace, and uncommitted, which was one of the things that they tried to do. So I flew to Texas 4 days before that convention, or 3 days before that convention, with that instruction to try to see to it that McGovern was shut out in Texas. And normally you would have thought, knowing what I knew about Texas politics at the time, where the left and the right, you know, gave no quarter and asked none, but the liberals usually hated the conservatives against the, you know, the Ralph Yarbrough people against the Connolly people. And it was, in this particular case, organized labor was against McGovern. Normally they would have been aligned with the liberals, but they were aligned with the Stop McGovern people, as were the conservatives. And of course, the Wallace people had no support for McGovern. So they had somewhere around 70% of the delegates were not for McGovern. So they could have very easily split all the delegates up among Wallace, Humphrey, and uncommitted. The governor tried to have an all uncommitted delegation, but there were factions within the convention that blocked somehow their having this kind of a result. And some of the people who were involved in trying to say, let's give McGovern his share here, let's be generous, which was very out of character for these guys, decided to give him his 27% or 28% or whatever it was. And the people who were doing that were the Connolly people.
The person who was going to be a Republican pretty soon.
That's exactly right, and who at that time was an unofficial advisor to Nixon.
Maybe the most damning evidence that the group was on this mission.
At that time, that's correct. But
didn't you all suspect it? I mean, because you surely didn't trust Connolly.
Absolutely had no idea that was going on. We didn't know our phone was tapped. We didn't know the dirty tricksters were out there. This was on. They caught the Watergate burglars on the 17th of June. Our convention was the second week of July in Miami. I didn't know my phone was tapped until the first week of September.
I have to stop and catch my breath. We need to take a break. You're hearing a story that I've never heard before from Spencer Oliver, and we've got friends who will help him tell that story after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. We're talking really about the presidential election of 1972 and the Watergate incident that was a part of it, and how it all related to a really interesting, I just have to say, a very clever, well worked out scheme on the part of the Republican establishment to ensure that George McGovern got the presidential nomination, and from our standpoint here in North Carolina, that Terry Sanford didn't get it. Sam Poole, you're here, and you were working on the campaign. Why didn't you figure out what was going on and put a stop to it?
Well, let me give you a little history, if I can, because of Spencer being here and his involvement. And, of course, it was his phone and the Watergate tap. And there's been so much about over the years about the Watergate and the things that we all know about. But there's been very little ever said about what was really on that phone. And if I can go back from the Sanford perspective, I go back to 1969, well, even before that, because Spencer and I were both very much involved in the Humphrey campaign, where Sanford had come in and worked very hard heading up that campaign after the convention and in an attempt to derail Nixon. And when he got involved in that campaign, just without belaboring this, at that point, Nixon was leading Humphrey by about 25 points. And we went to work on it and wound up that he ultimately lost by about a point and a half. But in that, I think Spencer, of course, was not the first time he'd been around Sanford, but got involved in it. And then in 1969, Spencer I called, Sanford called me and said, could you call Spencer Oliver and this one other fellow and come up to our place at Hound Ears and play golf, which we did. And we, after we played golf, we were sitting down in his sauna, and Sanford said that he was going to accept the presidency of Duke and run for president of the United States. And the other fellow sitting in the sauna with us said, I want the record to reflect that the temperature was 120 degrees in October when you said that. And that was sort of, and Sanford had looked at it and wanted, and to, that he really was interested and was going forward with it. And then during the process, even up until 1971, 72, we had, Terry had numerous conversations with Spencer, as did I, because Spencer and I had gone back a long ways. And then the students at Duke, Terry was not really saying he was going to run in 72, that he looked at the thing and the chart, and it was sort of, no, I hadn't made a decision. But the students at Duke, including Tom Drew, and as they talked about the couple today that occurred there, Court Moffitt and Bill Garrison and others, started a petition and got him on the ballot in North Carolina. And so we went to work on it, and it looked like that the great possibilities there of winning that primary, which would put Terry in real stead, because it was obvious that to most of the people in the political arena that there had to be a Southern voice to generate the support that was needed in the presidential campaign to win an election against Nixon. And so the students, but the thing that sort of upset that apple cart in the final analysis, he didn't get to run one-on-one against George Wallace, because the congresswoman, Shirley Chisholm from New York, came down and it gave the African-Americans their first opportunity in history to vote for somebody on a national scale, and that sort of, if you would, suck that vote out of the more liberal side of the party, and that was what got the campaign going. But and then going the time he's talking about, Terry had gone around and been very active in the campaign and looked like he could be the most viable candidate that would be the second choice of everybody we talked about. And of course, then we didn't know at that point, and as he said, didn't ever know until later that their strategy and the strategy that Spencer had engineered was laid out to creep, which was a committee to reelect Nixon, and that got us to that point.
Well, before we go back to Spencer, Hiding, you're watching this from a different angle at this
Not
time.
Really.
I mean, but from a different.
Certainly.
What was going on in your mind and the rest of the country and the rest of the what we'd call the Southern progressives who would like.
You mean the five of us in Mississippi and that kind of thing? I mean, no, that's what you got to know, is that for most of us, the biggest thing of all was to block George Wallace, period. Beating Nixon was absolutely essential. That wasn't the question. But the only person in the whole race that had a chance to beat Wallace. And why do you care about that? Because Wallace was fast on his way to getting a lock on what happened at the Democratic Convention, which is the reason later I came out for Jimmy Carter. Somebody had to beat him in the South. And certainly that second, of course, he was the most extraordinary man that had come out of Southern politics in a very long time. And for me and people like me, of whom there were a lot, he was the ideal candidate in every kind of way, national, local, regional, moderate, liberal. Can't ask for much more than that except a cape, you know, when you take off as political Superman. But it was a wonderful thing.
When did you know that it was going to be? I tell you what, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and continue this conversation. And I'm going to give you all a chance, my Hiding and Sam, to ask Spencer questions. If you joined us late, Spencer is the guy who's famous because his phone got tapped in the Watergate Enterprise.
Unfortunately.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. And I'm learning so much about presidential politics, particularly the presidential campaign of 1972, which is a heck of a lot more complicated than I ever imagined it would be. And Hiding Carter and Sam Poole, Bill Drew in the background, and I are enjoying hearing a guy who really followed it all the way through and beyond. And one of the reasons Spencer Oliver is so intriguing now is he's interested because when they tapped the phones, they tapped his phone. And they found out things that helped Richard Nixon by helping George McGovern put the other qualified Democrats out of business. It so if you join us late, that's what we've been talking about. And Spencer, I interrupted you.
No, it was a pattern that that they had put into place in late 1971 to try to accomplish just that, the undermining of the strongest Democratic candidates and the nomination of the weakest. They spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. They hired at least 50 of these saboteurs around the country. And they did everything they could to try to cause chaos and disruption and division within the Democratic Party, and they succeeded.
They didn't drive the car off to Chappaquiddick, of course.
No.
I mean, there were other possibilities that didn't exist.
But it was a time when Nixon was vulnerable, and they, in typical Nixon style, they decided to change the equation by engaging in some dirty tricks and dirty politics.
Well, in a democracy, it's not a brand new thing that opponents would try to harm or improve their chances of winning by having their opponents select a weaker candidate than they would if they left to their own devices. But this, what you described, Spencer, seems extraordinary. Had it happened before, and has it happened again?
I don't believe it has ever happened before or since like this, because illegal wiretapping is a very serious crime described by the wiretap statute, which meant that everybody who received the contents of the intercepted conversations, received the summaries or the notes or whatever they were, anyone who received it, acted upon it, used it, passed it on in any way, was guilty of a felony automatically. So in retrospect, when you look back, what they were doing was they were gathering information through my phone. They were summarizing it and putting it in something called the Gemstone Stationery. And they were sending it to John Mitchell and to H.R. Haldeman and Chuck Colson in the White House, so that you had the top echelons of the Republican campaign and the White House who were guilty of felonies simply by receiving this information.
They had some experience in the 64 campaign. They managed to get control of the telex operation at the Democratic headquarters and delivered all the flimsies over to the Republican, which of course suddenly was found out it was happening, and reporters were told to go to the Republican headquarters at the time the material was being handed over. And they had done a number of other things which were prelude to this, but nothing like it.
One of the things that
Mr. Sam
hiding Poole. And of course you, DG, and I have been involved in this in kind of politics for a long time and known Spencer for so long and known about the tapping and so forth, but learned something today that I didn't know, and that is, of course, there's no such thing as tapes because that technique was not available then, but the period of time that there's messages that came off the phone have not yet been available. And Spencer, can you talk about when that period?
Well, what I'm saying is that the tapes of the White House conversations in Nixon's taping system have now been, after the Supreme Court got them for the Irvin Committee and so on, and many of them have been released periodically and transcribed. But the tapes of Nixon's taping system in the White House between the 27th of May and the 17th of June, when the tap was on, have not been released.
Are they going to be released?
I don't know.
Wow. Well, guys, this I'm learning so much that's interesting, but what it does is lead to so many other questions and a realization that I don't know very much about this at all. So thanks particularly to you, Spencer Oliver, for coming and informing us, and also for increasing our curiosity about the things that we don't know yet. And Hyde and Carter, you're always able to make a good conversation even better. Sam Poole, it's great to be with you. And Tom Drew, we appreciate you bringing them. And thanks to you for listening. This has been D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.